And now,
Capital 263.
Welcome to Politics and Beyond on Capital 263. My name is Christopher Farai Charamba.
I'm Openyu Makoni Matenga.
And I'm Tawanda Henry Beatty. And yeah, welcome to the best political podcast across many countries by virtue of our guest today. And yeah, two episodes in a week. We had to have this emergency session because every day was being shuffled, or everyone was being shuffled. And we have a guest as well. Someone who perhaps Chris Openyu would probably be give a better intro. But yeah, we have a doctor here.
A real one.
Amongst us. He walks amongst us.
a real one. Openyu, go ahead. You are the...
Okay. I'm just waiting for his bio to load. Because it's me.
We can ask him to talk about himself.
No, because I feel like such an imminent personality requires an introduction. So let me, you know, throw the rose petals on the ground and allow him to walk on them. So Dr. Miles Blessing Tendi is a departmental lecturer in politics at the University of Oxford. He is interested in intellectual society and the state, the political role of African militaries, Southern African politics, especially Botswana, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Madagascar, Swaziland, and the role of regional organizations in crisis resolution in Africa. He is a regular contributor to The Guardian newspaper UK and has provided political commentary for the BBC, CNN, Sky News, and Politics and Beyond. Welcome, Dr. Tendi.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, that was extensive. You know,
it's all downhill from here. By the way,
all protocol observed. All protocol observed.
You know what I find funny is before we started recording, Dr. Tendi was saying to me, "Kuti ndarasa gwarare msangano." And now I find out, you know, he's there working with the BBC and the Guardian and all sorts of things. So I wonder, kutanyatso rasa gwarare msangano ndiani panapa?
Dinik.
That's how you know.
As long as we are all on the same page.
Yeah, I think we're pretty much all.
No, thank you for joining us today. We do appreciate having you here and look forward to what your thoughts are on the cabinet that was reshuffled. It had been a while since we've had a reshuffle, actually. And there were rumors a couple of weeks ago that it was going to happen, and then the president finally announced, and here we are with an interesting sort of reshuffle. Many think that the Lacoste faction has taken a huge blow.
Okay. Do you think that?
Who? Me?
You.
Yeah, no, I think once we start looking at the who's in, who's out, and where everyone's sort of been moved around, I could say that it looks like a battle victory for the G40 faction. I don't know if anyone...
Or a resurgence of gamma talks. You can look at it either way.
I don't know. I know. Admittedly, I'm outside, so I'm a little bit out of things. And when you're out of things, not actually on the ground, as you guys are, maybe you miss what the real current is. But I was looking at things on Twitter and Facebook. I was struck by how, and I don't know how much this translates to people's views on the ground, but I was just struck by how the conversation, the dominant narrative was about factions, when really there's an unfolding economic problem. And I would have thought the focus would have been on who took over the finance ministry and the macroeconomic ministry. This kind of didn't get, I thought anyway, the attention it deserved. It turned into Lacoste G40, and I was thinking to myself, but shouldn't this be about the economy? It really, if what's on social media is what's on the ground, it's quite a troubling observation about debate in Zimbabwean society right now, I would have to say.
I agree with you.
Yeah, to give us on the ground, Upenyu is much better placed. I recently emigrated to the UK. Henry's in Australia. So
we're all over the world. So, somebody should have told me.
So I said we're the best podcast across many countries by virtue of us being in many countries.
Uh-huh. In the multiverse. We're the best in the multiverse. Listen, on the ground, I think it's from what I've seen and heard, people are more we're all making the Chinamasa jokes about him being a minister of WhatsApp and a Facebook. What is it? WhatsApp group administrator in chief.
Yeah.
And I do agree with you. It's for me, it's concerning that we are not discussing the fact that the godfather of land barons, Ignatius Chombo, has now been given the keys to what's left in the piggy bank.
Indeed.
Or that Orbit Mpofu, who cannot account for the diamonds, is now, that's troubling. But perhaps what it is hysteria. And, it can't be undone. They're obviously not listening. So what we can do is make jokes about Chinamasa being group administrator in chief. So maybe that's our reaction to it.
Yeah, so I suppose we can just say what happened in the shuffle. Reassigned ministers, Honorable Ignatius Chombo moved from Home Affairs to Minister of Finance and Economic Development. Patrick Chinamasa from Finance to Cybersecurity Threat Detection and Mitigation. Walter Mzembe from Tourism to Foreign Affairs. Obet Mpofu from Macroeconomic Planning to Home Affairs. Simbarashe Mbengegui from Foreign Affairs to Macroeconomic Planning and Investment Promotion. Patrick Joao from Youth and Indigenization Empowerment to Public Service, Labor and Social Welfare. Xavier Kosukwere has Rural Development added back to Local Government, Rural Development and National Housing. Simon Kayamoyo to Media Information and Broadcasting Services. He was in the President's Office as a Minister of State. Christopher Mshoe, Minister of State in the President's Office, responsible for national scholarships. And Maxini Hlongwane has arts and culture added back to sport and recreation. The new appointments, Edgar Mbwembwe, who was Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, is now Tourism, Environment and Hospitality Industry Minister. Habiton Bonyongwe, who was Director of Intelligence, is now Justice, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Minister. Kane Matema is now Minister of Welfare Services for War Veterans, War Collaborators, former political detainees and restrictees. Chiratidzo Mabua is now Youth Development, Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Minister. She was Deputy Minister of Deputy Minister of Industry. Tokozile Matutu is now Minister of State for Mapetebele North. Webster Shamu back out from the cold as Minister of State for Mashonaland West. And Paul Chimedza, Minister of State for Mashingo Province. So out Priska Mfumira, who was Minister of Public Service. Chinga Dube, Minister of War Vets. And Feba Chidarikire. So that's the new
what
look.
What did Chidarikire do?
To get chucked out or where he was?
Both.
Where he was before.
Yeah.
Feba Chidarikire was minister.
One of the provincial ministers, no?
Yeah.
I think Sham was replaced him.
Yeah, I think he was minister. Okay. Yeah, Mash West.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Leave him alone. Let's move on.
So yeah, this is the new cabinet, and I suppose we can start with the people.
I mean,
I
was gonna say, to the question of the economic, why people aren't focusing on it, is that I think it's as soon as everyone read that, they were just like, my there must have been a collective sigh across the country, Kuti. Oh, no, I'm not serious. So, you know, you focus on the things that are released. The thief in chief, you know, Chombo, as Minister of Finance, is unfathomable.
With regards to looking at the issue of the economy and what's happened there. You've had Chinamasa, who many people have said, you know, in commentary, that he should step down because of how badly he's run the economy. But nobody, and when the shuffle was announced, you know, there was speculation that he'd be one to be moved, but nobody expected Chombo to be his replacement. And it's well known corruption allegations, and it doesn't seem to, I mean, his capabilities don't seem to suggest that he's the right man for the job. So it's quite puzzling, but you know, we'll just have to see how that appointment then translates.
All right, I mean, I would like to hear what the good doctor has to say, in as far as Chombo specifically, and maybe the criteria that was used was certainly not a meritocracy. So it wasn't certainly on his talents or his ability to manage an economic portfolio, but perhaps there's some political reasons that he was selected in terms of what he's willing to do for the party and for the president. I don't know what the doctor thinks about that idea of his merit.
call me Miles, please. I want to go back first, if I can, to this the notion of you know, we poke fun at things, you know, we crack jokes, we create the memes, all of that online. I understand it. It's one way of you could say coping with the absurdities, the governmental absurdities that go on in Zimbabwe. I can totally understand that. I appreciate it. But while that's effective, you know, it's a way of coping with the absurdities of government. I think it's also a danger in the sense that it also then makes the discourse and actions quite impotent. Mm-hmm. You know, we then crack jokes about it, we laugh about it, and then we move on, right? So what? Nobody's making serious economic arguments and getting angry about things to the point where people take actions to actually get things done, i.e. even if it's showing up to register at polling stations, or not that I'm advocating violence or anything of that sort, but some kind of protest. So I think it's effective coping, but I think it's made society quite impotent. We laugh it off and we move on. Nothing changes. Another thing happens. Another absurdity happens. And we laugh it off and we move on. I find that troubling.
Wouldn't political parties or opposition political parties be the ones to sort of bring the conversation into a focus? Is there anyone within the society who should sort of bear the responsibility of that?
I don't think it's up to opposition parties at all, or others may want to even say perhaps even intellectuals to write and think about things. I think every individual is a free thinking person. Every individual is an organic intellectual themselves, particularly in a society like Zimbabwe where you have a high education levels. So these are free thinking, critical people. The conversation they can easily have for themselves. But you see extremely bright, capable young people. Again, I'll refer to social media, and it's jokes. Right, so I don't know, it's coping, yes, or maybe it's the platform itself, social media, because in some ways it's not transformatory, You can do things on social media, but it doesn't actually change things on the ground. Maybe that's why the discourse turns into this comedy thing. I don't know, but there's something there that's not quite working in the way in which we engage with our politics. Maybe it's something we can toss around. I don't know.
Well, I'd like to add some observations, which is that we've seen lately the rise of satire as a response and as a form of commentary to the absurdity of our politics. And also, I do think that the Zimbabwean populace has been beaten into submission, as it were, because the avenues that are the normal avenues of expressing displeasure, protest, petition, talking to your member of parliament are not open. They're met often with state, the mshamu being waved at us. So it's a sense of frustration that I get from the jokes that are being cracked. It's also helplessness, but I believe that it's learned helplessness because I don't think we are creative in the way we protest. I like the recent the Pockets Out protest. I've forgotten what it's called, but
yeah.
That one, that's creative. And that's a way of expressing displeasure that doesn't... I mean, I read a statement the last week, I think, where it was banned for you to walk around with your pockets turned out. But that in and of itself is ridiculous. But, I mean, it's a way of engaging in ways other than with humor, because that, I think, has led us to be impotent as citizens when we have a little bit more power than we believe we do.
Yeah. And I'm amazed. Some of the things that one of the great uses of social media actually has been around what's going on at the registration points. Zach, yes, fine, the process is slow. There are not as many points as we would like. But the few that are there, I'm not seeing any remarkably long queues. And you wonder, like, that faith in politics seems, electoral politics anyway, seems to have died. And then you wonder what other avenues are there. I don't know. I don't know.
But you're the doctor. We're paying you the big bucks to know these answers.
I think the case of Zimbabwe seems to be a very unique one where you can't actually be predictive of you know what will happen. I'm sure when Minister Chinamasa went to bed last week, Friday, or even the day before yesterday, he didn't expect to be heading a completely new ministry that is cybersecurity threats and mitigation.
Yes,
you know, it's a ministry that I think was under ICT, so the ministry that Minister Supermande Wanzira has now, or rather it was a portfolio that was there, and there is the cybersecurity bill that is coming into, or that is being tabled or has been tabled. And I think that's basically what he is going to be working on, you know, this cybersecurity bill. Social media, they've said, or there's this term that is stop abusing social media that's been coming up quite a bit. When the price hikes happened, social media was blamed for that, for stirring up panic in society. So I wonder how much of it, well, one, he's prepared to do, and two, what exactly will come out of this cyber security ministry and the cybersecurity bill.
I think we're going to see a poster type restrictive bill coming out of him, and I think that's why Chinamasa was put to that ministry, because he is, for all his flaws, quite an inefficient individual, and with his legal background, I think that out of all of the ministers right now, he probably is best positioned to do the research and organize the ministry around writing a bill that does both things. It aligns or conforms with the constitution so that it's not very challengeable in the court system, because that's the first thing that will happen. And secondly, is restrictive enough, or you know, does what it's meant to do before the next elections. He was also similarly rigid in the finance portfolio, is also a possibility. You know, Chris, you and I say he's incompetent, and you say no, he was restricted. I think we can meet in the middle and say he was both incompetent and restricted in the finance ministry, but more so the restriction than the incompetence led to the decisions that he made.
I'm more, I can see how, you know, the logic for it, and that I think it was George Charamba today tried to explain why the ministry was set up. Fine, I get that. Like in terms of where the government is coming from. But what, looking at it from outside, I mean, you've got it, increasing economic difficulties, but you expand cabinet. You're basically creating a whole new ministry. You're going to need people to fill. That's more money going into that particular ministry, the cyber ministry, and then more fundamentally, I think that stuff is very hard to do. It's not ordinary surveillance, like where you put police at a roadblock. And then they do surveillance. This is online stuff. It's very expensive, sophisticated technology. I think the only country in the world that's really made advances towards trying to really grapple with this is China. And the state, there's a lot of money to spend on this. So it's kind of, you know, the Zimbabwean state has these grand ambitions, right, to do things, say, that the Chinese state does, which is clearly where some of these ideas have come from. But I don't think practically they can actually do any of this. So in some ways, I think it's if I can break into Shona, it's Nyangai Sinchinchisinkarumi. You know, something that boxed a lot can't bite.
So WhatsApp, for instance, has end-to-end encryption. So unless we're in a group which is being monitored and those messages are being, you know, taken out of the group and saved, it's impossible for the government to know what we're saying to each other in a conversation on WhatsApp, unless they have access to my phone, unless they then, you know what I mean? So I agree with Miles that these are very lofty ideas, but the fact that terrorists can still keep America awake at night should tell you something about the ability of people who are intentional to be able to hide themselves on the internet, and people who are not so intentional to not trigger the alarm, as it were. And I mean, the government has been arresting people for posting things on Facebook. So I think, because I do feel like there's going to be another wave of hysteria about, you know, don't post this on Facebook, don't say this on WhatsApp groups. This happened 2 weeks ago when we were in fuel queues. So I think people just need to remember that it's not as easy as the government makes it out to be, and just remain calm.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of fear-mongering that happens, and, you know, in a society where people believe every one in six people is a government spy or CIO agent, you really, information or people are quick to distrust. So if you say that, oh, they are watching our Facebook, or oh, they are watching our WhatsApps, or in this group there are C10s and things like that, people really then, you know, take those things a bit too seriously. There's a bit of paranoia that I think a lot of Zimbabweans have, and I mean, you see it on Twitter. If someone without an avatar follows someone else, they'll immediately think that it's a state agent looking at their tweets or something like that. And I don't think that's necessarily true. People,
really, you would say that. You agent yourself.
if I were an agent, yeah, I suppose No, but honestly, I don't think the paranoia is a reflection of what's actually true and what the government's capabilities are. And as Mal said, they really do have these ambitious plans, but our government does not have money. So, and I've said this on this platform, if you were to ask a lot of our ministers or government officials for their email addresses, they will give you Gmail accounts, Yahoo accounts, Hotmail accounts. Most of them don't even have a @gov.zw account or something like that. We are struggling to get servers for ZEC and voter registration. So for them to set up an entire cybersecurity ministry. And monitor people online and all these things, I think it's not just, you know, it's very ambitious for them because they don't even have the basic things that, you know, organizations have and you can set up very easily by yourself on your home computer.
But I think I'm sure they just want to stop charging Pastor Evan with undermining a constitutionally elected government and find something to charge him with that is less treasonous. I'm almost 100% certain is that that's literally, that was the conversation, is how come we keep charging this guy with this? Because I think even to some of it sounds ridiculous to charge people like Evan with that, but it would be fine to charge them with something under a cybersecurity act. So I don't really think they are in under any illusions that they'll be able to read what you have in your WhatsApp inbox, but they'll be able to take out the leaders that have organically risen up on social media or charge them under that and make it very different for a second crop or a new crop of Evans or Fadzis to rise up without it being clandestine, or you know, people will even be afraid to watch the videos because you're congregating on an online space that was propagating treasonous material, and that language, I guarantee you will hear it very soon.
Well, one thing I do know is that broadcasting is certain kinds of broadcasting is illegal in Zimbabwe, so posting live videos to Facebook technically under the law is illegal because you have to have a broadcasting license to broadcast. And so I expect that maybe the cybersecurity bill will deal with some of those issues. It definitely will be dealt with as well in the broadcasting law. There's a new Minister of Information, Simon Kayamoyo, who, for me, I think is just aligning the party line or party messaging with that of the government rather than having two voices.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Oh, hello?
Yeah, carry on.
I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Chris.
What if I'm a Zimbabwean in South Africa posting messages, live broadcasting about Zimbabwe from South Africa? Would I still be able to be charged?
No, those are...
Yeah.
I don't think so, because you're out of their jurisdiction.
But let's say I came home to visit my mom for like a week.
And you're doing it within Zimbabwe, then yes, because you're...
No. I did the live broadcast last week in South Africa, right? I'm normally resident in South Africa. Then I come home to visit my mom for a week, but I'm a Zimbabwean with a green passport. Would they still... does that make sense?
So, I don't know if Miles has anything on this, but from a legal perspective in Australia, what they do is, for example, with child pornography or with revenge, it might have come from outside the country, but the crime is when it is opened or disseminated within the country. So, for example, if you are a Australian person and you have a server of, you know, that kind of material. So, for example, if you're a Zimbabwean and your servers are based in America or in England, if it is being disseminated or being opened in Zimbabwe, you're then charged under Zimbabwean laws because it is affecting Zimbabweans. So it doesn't matter where the information is coming from. The crime occurs when it's opened or when it's viewed in Zimbabwe, and you are still the same person that has committed their crime regardless of where you are in the world. So I'm sure that they'll pretty much take that kind of stance, because it's similar to, you know, the BBC broadcasting in or pirate radio stations, if you think about it. You know, Voice of America and that kind of thing. I don't know if Miles has any input on that point.
No, it's just more, it would require quite sophisticated intelligence sharing. So here in the UK, you've got GCHQ, a massive body, receives a huge amount of money, but everything that actually goes on in this big complex is all shadowy. We don't know much. So they would share, whether it be French intelligence doing this kind of thing. Yeah, we have an English citizen here who does this, you know, and they'll share stuff. They know people to watch online. But again, going back to this, to me, it's the costs, the practicalities. We simply don't have the capacity. And even from a point of view where, you know, because these laws, there can be one targeting citizens, surveillance on citizens, but also, you know, in the sense of protecting the state or government itself from external cyber attacks. But when you look at our government, I mean, somebody here made that point earlier, you get in touch with, say, a particular government official, you get a private email address. There's no real e-government. There's not much that's online anyway of the state that somebody would want to, launch a cyber attack towards. So to me, when I saw that, I listened to the government's justification. I'm like, okay, it makes sense in a country with a functional state with resources, but in Zimbabwe, just lack of capacity, and you wonder, like, who's going to police all of this? They have a hard enough time policing activities on the ground. So in some ways, I think it's a reality, if I may be brutal, almost a particularly given the events from, I think, a fortnight ago or a week or so around the hoarding of goods. There was a lot of panic going on among citizens and stuff. Almost a knee-jerk reaction to that is my sense. But a clearly thought-out plan, you know, because you've got to have a structure for this. Capacity's got to be there. The skills, the money is simply absent. And then when you build up a department like that, I mean, just look at when the FBI was set up in the United States, and you had somebody like J. Edgar Hoover, in charge of it. He had a grand vision, you know, for what this organization would become. Chinamasa, for all his, you know, he's got a lot of positives, things that he's good at. This is not the kind of guy who's going to have a grand vision about how to build up a department of this sort. Is Chinamasa even on Twitter?
He's the type of person who writes his password on his desk calendar.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I mean. I mean, so they, I just don't see what what the point of it was. But can I just see, moving away from cyber, something that I think, another thing, I know at the beginning we kind of like about, I went on about how the economic arguments kind of fell away. But the other thing that I saw in this reshuffle that didn't quite come through was around exactly what Mugabe's overarching goal was. So I think, this is Tendai Biti. Last night on Twitter, his response, these are exact words he said. He tweeted, "This reshuffle is not founded on rationality and objectivity, but it is proof that the Mugabe succession plan is now being executed." So there's one of your so-called shining opposition lights getting it completely wrong about what this was about. I think in reality what Mugabe did, somebody earlier, one of you mentioned, oh, it's the comeback, the resurgence of Gamma Talks. And I think it's not so much resurgence of gamma talks, but you're onto something important. It is interesting that a lot of these characters, Chimeza, Shamu, Kayamoyo, Edgar Mbwembwe himself, Edgar Mbwembwe's parliamentary seat used to belong to Solomon Rujuru. It is surprising that a lot of these characters, you know what I mean, have been brought back to cabinet or been promoted. The question is why. And then you also wonder, Emerson Fine, Mnangagwa's had a lot of his powers trimmed, but he wasn't kicked out, nor was anybody else seen as a lion to him. They were kept inside, right? None of the so-called G40 guys were kicked out either. So my sense, in spite of everything, there are a lot of disgruntled people who've been demoted and stuff, but they're all still inside there. The old so-called Gamma Talks or old Mujuru wing of ZANU that was disgruntled and marginalized has suddenly been brought in. What I think Robert has really done is really this cabinet, the symbolism of unity, pulling everybody back in right before the election, right? I think that's what is that's what this is really about. And for, say, Tendai to go on about, oh, it lacks rationality, it lacks objectivity, it's about succession. I don't think this is about succession yet. It's about the election, getting everybody in. Akuna Ntamba Boram Sangwa, Akuna Ntamba Boram Jiva, all that stuff that was being said. They are all in there. Happy or not, you're in there. You're at the table, you're at the feeding table. The question then becomes, okay, fine. If ZANU, if Mugabe has played this unity game ahead of the election, question is the opposition watching and learning? If Tendai's response is anything to go by, I guess not. So you have to wonder, will the opposition also place unity above everything else as Mugabe has done? I think that's the real, that's the other thing that was really on the table there. That's kind of being missed. ZANU is slowly pulling together.
Yeah, no, I think that's a brilliant point. And to answer you in a word, no, I don't think that the opposition will pull together by virtue of that there's not a strong enough leader there to pull them together. For Mugabe to do this, there needs to be a Mugabe. There needs to be a center of power, for lack of a better term. And right now, as it is, I don't think there's the center is not holding in the opposition.
What needs to be done, do you think, for the center to hold in the opposition?
It's that's a whole another episode of podcast in itself. I've always been an advocate of the fact that these guys don't understand the concept of a coalition, and that you're getting together as an amalgamation of your weaknesses and not as your strength. So no one can ever begin to negotiate a coalition from a position of strength, even when you have hung parliaments and hung governments. It's both acknowledging that you failed to win, so two losers must come together in that kind of light. But you sort of have an opposition space where everyone believes that they're strong enough to go it alone. And they'll never get anywhere as long as that's the prevailing ideology in the majority of the opposition.
I think there's a lack of common purpose and a lack of understanding that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And because of that, then people honestly believe that they can go it alone, which, you know, I was there when the opposition was formed in 1990, what was it, 9? And
your diapers.
The problem really no, I was in high school.
Oh. Okay.
Children, I was in high school.
I was like, you're trying to make yourself seem wiser than you are.
No, I am actually wise. But my point is that the thing that pisses me off the most about the opposition is the very thing that I hate the most about ZANU-PF, which is the ability to coalesce around a single problem or a single need to defeat an enemy. And the opposition is so busy fighting each other, fighting for positions and power that they do not have, cutting up a pie that does not exist, that you cannot even then acquire said pie or said positions or said power. And I don't understand why. I mean, this morning I listened to, I think, who's the spokesperson for the MDC, literally saying we're waiting for an act of God for us to get it together.
Is this
and for me that doesn't make sense. Where
Gutu? Is this Orbit Gutu?
No, I think it was Sangare's spokesperson. Was it not Sangare's spokesperson?
Luke Tambora.
Yes, Luke Tamborikika. Yes. Yeah. Saying, you know, we're going to wait for Morgan Tsvangirai to recuperate. And for now, I think the strategy is to pray for him to get better. But the man has cancer. So you tell me what is the logic behind... Because you know what? Even if he's okay, cancer is not something that you play with. So having dealt with it in our house, you know, it's not something that somebody can then go on the campaign trail. And this is less than a year to the election. So surely, and there's no succession plan. There's no plan at all. That is depressing.
I think...
And I think just say, again, just to back that up, what Upen was saying. And then, as was the case in 2013, the argument that may come out of opposition forces is will probably be that the election was simply rigged, and this is what came out in 2013, without stopping to recognize the very significant failings of the opposition itself. And I think, and then when we go back, if we're to connect this again to the things at the beginning, we're all like, yeah, but what's happened to the Zimbabwean society? You know, satire, we'll do comedy about things and then just move on. We're not registering to vote. It's probably that, this deep-seated disillusionment with opposition politics. And people just go kind of go, life goes on, sort of thing. And I said, maybe that's the crux of the... because it wasn't like this. The 90s, the 1999, who Penyu mentions, it was a hive of real political engagement, churches, trade unions, and that's all dissipated now.
But I mean, Miles, the socioeconomic structure of the country has changed so much.
Indeed.
From 99. Indeed. You can have a hive of political activity when there's organized employment and there's structures already. There's ZCTU, there's structures to organize around. You can call a mass day away in 1999 because those structures are in existence. ZANU has killed all of that. All the trade unions, all the formal employment in the country is gone. You can't organize employees because there are no employees to organize. You talk about voter apathy. In 2008, people voted in their numbers and they were beaten. A lot of opposition activists were beaten and killed, and they won the election and still couldn't take power. So I don't think it's solely a problem with the opposition or its failings, many as they are. It's putting the cart before the horse, because the failings begin with the center, which is ZANU-PF. Even allowing, I would acknowledge that the opposition has not been as, you know, the best it can be. It has allowed a lot of its power base to be whittled away, but it's the economy that's whittled away a lot of this opposition power base. Nowadays, you have to survive. It's not about politics anymore. In 99, it was almost in a position where you could afford to be political. Now you can't.
But you can't afford not to be political either, because you're unemployed. You're sitting at home with no food.
Politics,
you're sitting at home
everywhere.
With no... Yes. You can't afford not to be political
nationally
either.
Yeah, but if you...
It doesn't make sense to make that
And I take your point about how the changing economy, you know, the unions broke down, you know, all of that, all the old bodies of, you know, civil society engagement, you know, they wilted away. But even then, fine, the formal economy broke down and your ZCTUs lose relevance. But you still got your informal sector. That's where all the people went. That's an arena for increased organization. So it can still become something else. The churches were more, you know, the major institutional ones, the big ones in the old days, you know, the Catholic Church or whatever. Now you've got all these Protestant churches all over. Those are sites for politics too, but the kind of political engagement you'd expect isn't happening. It's all prosperity gospel. So it's fine. The economic is done, but there's still a lot citizens can do for themselves. And I'm not making an excuse for ZANU. ZANU has done a lot of dodgy things. But I would like to see ZANU being, you know, put somewhere in the middle, and the opposition's failings coming to meet that at the middle as well.
Yeah.
All too often, the conversation is one-sided. When this is all over next year, 2018, if ZANU happens to win, which I think they probably will, what's going to come out is the election was rigged. biometric voter registration. election. Everything else is forgotten.
I'll use that point as a good segue to get into. Go ahead.
I just wanted to go back a bit to the aspect of unity, because I think it's a completely new dimension that I hadn't seen discussed, and it makes then sense. Again, as I speak about Simon Kayamoyo at Information, because there is then a unity. I mean, the Zim Papers has been accused of being partisan and of being factionally aligned. But if he is then speaking for the party and also speaking for the government and in control of the media institutions, then it brings again that aspect of unity, or it should essentially, where the party and the state and all the media institutions that are associated with it are then speaking with the same voice.
Yeah, no, you're right there. I was going to go into the new Justice, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Minister, because I think that's something that also flew under the radar in the same way the Finance Ministry flew under the radar, because here you have Bunyongwe, ex-military and ex-CIO boss, being put in charge of Justice, Legal and Parliamentary Affairs, the ministry which ZEC itself nominally reports to, in my understanding, which for me is quite worrying, because people have already complained about the militarization of the Electoral Commission, or of how many ex-military are actually hold positions in the commission. So I don't know. For me, that was something that really stuck out to me as a worrying move. And I ask, the Bunyongwe is not one of the most powerful power couples in Zimbabwe right now. It's
like, they are. My Bunyongwe is the chairman of ZIMRA, and now Wa Bunyongwe is justice. I wonder if he'll, well, he technically should then have to give up his seat as director of intelligence.
He has to.
Then, you know, who's going to take over from that is also another interesting question. But yeah, Miles, your thoughts on the justice?
I think with him he's got a law degree, so I think he can hack it. He can do the job. But I think more fundamentally, he had a troubled time as Director General of the Intelligence Body. I think he'd been in charge for a very long time now. It's a very divided institution. There was a lot of feuding going on. And I think for somebody like him moving on to this new posting, new challenge, I think it's a breath of fresh air. I think life had become quite stale for him at the Intelligence Body. But to the job itself, like I say, I think he can hack it. He has the law experience. But more than that, I think I kind of move past trying to understand, you know, these appointments strictly as militarization of institutions, particularly when it comes to him. He was a soldier in the about 97. That's when he's moved to CIO.
1999.
1999, sorry. Yeah. And so from the late 1990s, this guy's been wearing a suit. He was civilianized. So to say militarization now, I mean, he's been retired major general for some time now, and then became a civilian, became an intelligence officer. I think to say when it comes to him, I think slightly unfair if I want to put it that way.
This is
an intelligence man. He's been civilianized for over a decade now.
Can I add to that?
C-10 is civilians.
Hello?
It's part of the security in the Constitution. It's part of the security class in the Constitution. How is that a civilian job?
It's a civilian job. He hasn't been a soldier for over a decade.
Constitutionally is considered part of the security cluster. He can't hold the C-10 and the ministry because the Constitution refuses for him to be part of the security cluster.
But it's a security role, as far as I don't know. But so is the police. The police is under security. But it's not part of the military. You wouldn't call that the security institutions.
But you would refer to proper like army figures going into. And he hasn't been in the army since the late 1990s. He's been a civilian since. So I think it's a bit unfair on him.
I accept the guys with the gun.
It's true, there are soldiers there, but this guy's been a civilian.
I don't know.
The 90s.
Yeah.
And for you, Henry, he worked as a lawyer at Atherstone.
Like
and
a
Cook.
Jack. No, I know you were.
Yeah, so he's been in the civilian workforce for quite a while now. He graduated from the University of Zimbabwe in the early 90s. He was awarded a prize as best co-student in his stream. He's credible, if not a good candidate. He's credible.
I'm not saying he's not able to do the job from a legal perspective because I am aware of his legal qualifications. I'm saying that it will lead to a militarization in terms of having more military influence based on his history in the ministry, and particularly in the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission and the Judicial Service Commission, which have already had accusations of having a lot of ex-military in them. And the problem we have with ex-military in the opposition is because they're easy to muster and organize around their traditional power structure of the military. So, for example, if you were to lead to accusations of ZEC not being an independent commission, or the Judicial Service Commission not being independent, or of rigging not being independent, everyone would immediately say, well, you have so much military in ZEC that they are, who knows if they're not still following orders from the government. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but I totally accept. I mean, I see the concerns and many of them legitimate. But my point was simply it's a bit. But when looking at him, slightly unfair. He's been a civilian for some time. Slightly unfair. And then one other thing I think we should as much as I see how much the military has been an impediment to democratization in Zimbabwe. But I think we should also appreciate, for instance, how never lose sight of how the military itself is also a very divided institution. Solomon Mujuru was seen as a figure who championed succession politics within ZANU. He's the biggest military honcho we've had since 1980, right? By the time Vitalis Zhinavashe dies, the same man who once said we'll never salute anybody who didn't fight the war, by the time he dies in I think it's 2009, whatever it was that he died, he's turned against. He's quite critical of ZANU-PF. So they also let's not paint them all with the same brush. They may be in the Ministry of Justice, but I think a lot of them are quite self-critical. Certainly the conversations I've had with some of them, you'd be surprised. Self-criticism that they can come up with. I mean, they're human too. Think about things.
Is this all included in your book?
No, we're just having a friendly chat.
I would like to cite you on some of these sources.
they're quite self-critical. So I totally understand that the army as an institution has been an impediment to democratization, but it's also very different. There's a lot of division there. There's self-criticism. There's some people who believe in democracy and some don't. So let's also not paint them all with the same brush. But I take your point. They have been problematic.
going back to some of the people that were shuffled around, Mzembe to Foreign Affairs and Foreign Affairs Minister or ex Mbengegui to macroeconomic planning. I don't know your thoughts on
what
that.
What a demotion. What a demotion.
That for me, I think for me that was, aside from Chinamasa, that was the biggest demotion of the lot. And I doubt he saw it coming. I honestly didn't. I think Mzembe, you know, someone said he's been gunning for the post of Foreign Affairs Minister for a while. And I think after the WTO thing didn't pull through, this is the kind of role I think he really wants to be in. Macroeconomic planning hasn't been a ministry that has done anything, because finance usually deals with all the economic stuff. And when Obed Mpofu was there, he was very quiet. Industry is...
It's rude to speak in when you eat in our culture.
Industry was a lot more... deals a lot more with issues of trade and stuff like that. So I don't know, you know, what he's going to do in that role. But yeah, thoughts on Mzembe and Mbengegui?
I'd go back to the earlier. I had a dig at Chinamasa to say, you know, about, like, I was like, I went on about J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, you gotta have a vision. I'd say the same thing about Mbengegui. He never really put himself forward as Foreign Affairs Minister. Kind of always hung back. To be honest, Foreign Affairs for the last, I think, two decades now has really been defined by the particular, Robert Mugabe's particular views, whether it's his fight with Blair or Gordon Brown or George Bush. And these guys kind of like took the lead. So he was never a visionary figure in the Foreign Affairs Department. He's not a Henry Kissinger or anything. And then now you throw him into economic planning. Is he a Deng Xiaoping type? You know what I mean? Again, you know, this is again, when you give somebody the kind of like a portfolio, they got to have a grant. It's not there in the same way that I see Chinamasa as well with cybersecurity. He can't do this stuff. This is why I keep going back more than anything else. This was just about unity, not really about getting stuff done.
I think he's just there for the benefits. I mean, if it's a decent enough portfolio, okay. But he's not an all-star.
I think he'll be gutted, though. I mean, I think...
Why?
Because trips.
Aside from the trips, though, I mean, I've heard from different people in the diplomatic sector that, you know, he was quite liked by other diplomats around the world. I don't know how Mzembe will be, you know.
But likability is not effectiveness.
Yeah, that's.
It's not the same thing.
No, it's not a vision. It's not a foreign policy vision.
I'm talking
vision.
about him and how he's going to feel. You say that if he picks up the check, I think he'll be quite gutted to lose the post that he had. But Mzembe, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on him.
He's very ambitious. That's been clear for a long time, hence the... but part of the story with trying to, you know, particularly the tourism gig, partly had to do with his partner. She's got she badly wanted to be in Madrid. She's Cuban, Spanish speaking. So I think partly was
very
pressure.
Nice person,
yeah. But she's a nice mom, but I think partly kind of like homesick. So partly I think it was family wanting to, you know, that international stage, the big world tourism thing. But he's an ambitious individual. But again, I go back to visions. Let's see if he'll be able to really carve out, you know, a particular foreign policy vision plan for Zimbabwe beyond the particularities of Mugabe himself. I think Mugabe has really defined foreign policy for a long time. Whether Walter can, you know, make that ministry his own it in ways that Mbengegui never did, it only time reveals. Somehow I doubt it.
I think he's very lucky in that he's coming into the ministry at a time where England, the British government particularly, is warming up to reopening communications with the
you've just touched on a subject I can talk about until until kingdom
so
come.
With Zimbabwe post Brexit and all that, and I think that he's young, you know, he's good looking, he cuts a nice figure in a suit, and if he's now the face of Zimbabwe, I think that you will definitely see post 2018 if they win and they keep the same portfolios, you'll definitely see a lot more, particularly if he's given rein, if he's given leeway to go on a diplomatic offensive. I think you'll definitely see a warming up of relations with the rest of the world, because he's that type of person that would be able to do that. And also, just going from his BBC Hard Talk interview and some of the interviews that he's had, he's painted himself as a moderate and almost a reformational figure. And I think that Mugabe is comfortable with him being that in as that he'll sort of have that. That he can contradict Mugabe, at least even in closed door meetings and in some interviews, or the government in small ways, but which are very significant to opening up relations.
Can I throw something out there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah, I know I banged on about all this unity cabinet. Mugabe is pulling everything together now. What's the opposition going to do? But something that's still at the back of my mind. This cabinet, the way it's designed, the personalities, individuals in there, how much of it is Mugabe entirely? Or is it 50-50 with Grace Mugabe? Or is it actually Grace here pulling the strings? That's kind of still at the back of my head, despite everything I said before. How much Grace is there in these appointments now? She seems to throw her weight around a lot.
I don't think there's a handful of people who I don't think would have been Mugabe's first choices for these ministries, including Chombo Chombo for finance, for instance. I think historically Chombo has never been put near the kitty. And then Bonyongwe would make sense. João, I think for public service, actually that one makes sense to me. For Mugabe, it would make sense for Mugabe. Mpofu for home affairs, that one doesn't make sense because he's more in the economic, on the economic side of things rather than the, handling domestic issues.
Yeah, I think there definitely is an element of the Grace Mugabe. I mean, if you look at it now, I think someone mentioned that you have now three ministries that are held Kwazimba, three key ministries, which is finance, mines, and public service and labor, with Chombo, Chidakwa, and João. I definitely think that the João one to public service, there's a lot of influence there. I mean, public service holds NASA. And there's a lot of funds with NASA and NSB and all the things that fall under the public service ministry. My Mfumira out is not something I could say I saw coming. Some people did mention it though, but there has been talk that she was aligned to the Mnangagwa faction, or that she was partial to it rather than to say that she was fully aligned. And so that could be them or the G40 faction or that side of it seizing control of such a key ministry where it comes to what the portfolio has or what the ministry has in terms of resources under its control.
Yeah. And would be remiss if we didn't talk as youth, or as youthful people, relative to our president.
You didn't call him Goblin once today. Well done.
I think he's respecting Miles.
Yes. Miles, I don't think Miles knows my history as much as he knows as much as he knows about Chris. But yes, the goblin. And I didn't call Chombo Cisco either. I forgot to call Chombo Cisco. Thanks for reminding me.
Why did you call him Cisco?
Because of his hair.
The white hair.
Ah, yeah. I didn't put two and two together. I get it now. I totally get it.
Of his hair and his proclivity to panty dropping.
Wow. Oh, dear.
Oh, no, these things are public records. Miriam is the one who graced us with that wonderful dossier during their divorce proceedings. So it's not my fault.
With the
new Minister of Youth Development, Indigenization and Empowerment. I think, Chris, it was your status that said she's 55 years old, is she?
Yeah, born in 1962, was Comrade Chiratidzo Mabua. João, I think, was 50, so we've gone up about 5 years, which, you know, is 20 years above the constitutionally defined age of what a youth is. I know she worked with the International Labour Organization for about 20 years or something like that. So she has capacity in terms of qualifications, but with regards to youth issues, it you know, as Miles was talking about the vision, it needs somebody who really understands or is a youth or knows what, you know, relates to the youth. There's also the indigenization
aspect. You've got to be able to connect with them, understand how they talk. I just don't think he was trying to actually fix anything here. I mean, for the country.
It's fascinating.
He's fixing Zanuck.
It's fascinating that while they have their whole campaign for 2018 is youth vote, I'm baffled as to why they would pick her. João was 50, but he was youthful in his interests, we could say. He was more relatable to young people. Like that cool older brother that takes you to Marasta, or, you know, buys you your first beer. But I don't understand why, when there's such a big focus on the youth in this next election, that they would pick someone who is like this. On the indigenization side, I suppose from her experience at Deputy Ministry of Industry, I think, she perhaps, you know, is more capable of that. But I thought that indigenization, in my understanding, was now something that they had sort of abandoned as a push. So besides the party unity and besides that rationale, it's a completely illogical appointment for me. I don't know if anyone has any insider knowledge that would tell me why she was good for this role.
I think she's completely expendable, and I think she's there to keep the seat warm.
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah, I think.
But also,
so. I mean,
she's also from Mash. Where's she from? Mash West. Where's that's something we haven't spoken about, is the regional balance in this new cabinet as well. It seems quite regionally balanced.
Yeah, but it's not very gender balanced.
Mm.
How many How many women got in there?
Two.
I don't think they care.
Yeah,
the women.
No, well,
no,
the
Mugabe.
Mugabe.
Oh no, Mugabe. Mugabe doesn't care.
And but also,
and if we were to say, you know, to the earlier question about how much of this is Grace as well.
Yeah,
and she's the head of the Women's League, and she's not bothered that it's not 50-50.
No, because
she's waiting for the big fight when she says there needs to be a woman in the presidium.
But
there needs to be a woman vice president.
But little representation below that.
The thing is, I don't think she's ready to support the rise of another woman. So you have women who are really subordinates. Mabua, nobody was ever mentioned or will ever be mentioned in a power matrix. But if you have a woman who you appoint to maybe, say, Minister of Finance or Minister of Foreign Affairs or
Defense some of these, Minister.
You see bigger ministries, then that woman's profile immediately shoots up and they become contenders in whatever sort of matrix someone might want to put them in. And I don't think Grace would want to, you know, create rivals for herself, especially where she is trying to position herself as the only female politician who counts in the game.
Sadly, because you'd also want to, beyond that, giving the big portfolios to female members once, but also strength in numbers. I mean, you really can't get things done when you don't have a large, you know, female critical mass. And it's just two women, I think, were appointed, if I remember well. That's jarring.
Too, as well.
Yeah, that's jarring. And yet we signed up to all these SADC protocols and UN conventions to mainstream gender and stuff, and nothing happens. And again, that was not a conversation on social media. I didn't see anybody mention gender. It was all about Lacoste and G4.
Wait, Dotha, where the feminists? Where are you feminists with this?
Well, that's what I was going to say. The ZANU-PF is fundamentally anti-feminist. So why
I think
even
Zimbabwe generally is anti-feminist.
Don't get me started. The rest of the podcast will be around.
I would never self-describe as a feminist because I know how problematic that is. But I generally see that the one thing that whether it's Changirai or Mugabe that they generally agree on is that they're not a fan of feminism.
Yes, women should be in the kitchen cooking, and don't we know?
I don't know, as vice presidents, technically. That's what they believe.
But that's what it essentially boils down to. I think, listen, this, bless her heart for even showing up for the signing, for the swearing in, but she's not there for long. And as Miles rightly said, she doesn't have the charisma to outshine, I want to say Lady Gaga, Grace.
Is that what she's referred to on this show?
You see, the thing is, you see, every week people try to come up with these, you know, new things of how they refer to people. And these are the people who are Arasa Gwarare Msangano, not me.
No, but sorry. Miles, to challenge you quickly on just to go back on that tweet that you brought up.
The Tendai one. Yeah.
So he says this is proof that the Mugabe succession plan is now being executed. Are we sure it was the Robert Mugabe succession plan he was referring to, but perhaps he was referring to the Grace Mugabe succession plan?
I think they're a team. I think they sit down together and really plan this stuff. It's 50-50. They're doing everything together. So it's a joint one. But I don't think this was the succession plan. I don't think this is what he was really doing. I think he was pulling everybody together, the symbolism. And contrary to what people think, I think the attacks on Emerson will die down. Emerson won't. Nothing will happen to Emerson at the December conference. He's got his eyes on the election first. Succession, I think, a succession plan will really be rolled out after the election next year. And for Tendai Biti not to see that, you know, it's staring you in the face. ZANU is pulling together. That's what this really means. You have to pull together too. And he just didn't get it. And they'll tell us next year, election yakarigwa.
So, we've gone quite past our usual time. It's fine. But just so that we wrap up, biggest winners, biggest losers out of this cabinet reshuffle. Upenyu, we can start with you.
Webster
Shamu. Okay, Webster Shamu as the biggest winner. Biggest loser?
Priska Mpumira.
Okay, Prisca, I don't know why. Mfumira. I don't know. Okay, Priska Mfumira. I don't know why you're sounding a bit distant. Henry, biggest winners, biggest losers?
Biggest winner for me is Walter Mzembe, and the biggest loser is Chinga Dube. He barely tasted power before he was removed, so I don't think he was given his standard ZANU-PF time to eat.
Man, Chinga was subbed in and subbed out. Like, that was so...
Yeah. I mean, but like... if you look like that, just being part of the team, I think he's just happy to be there.
That's like being a second half sub and then, you know, being subbed out Mugabe, before the game.
I think Mugabe was tired of looking at him in cabinet, to be honest.
Wow, Henry, wow. Yeah, no, Chinga, shame. For me, biggest winner, I would say it's a tie between Mzembe and Shamu. Shamu is out in the cold, and he's back now. And the biggest loser, when you're dropped from cabinet, I think that's it. So Prisca Mfumira, from where she is to where she's gone now, maybe they'll try find something or somewhere where they can slot her, but I don't know. Miles, biggest winner, biggest loser?
Biggest winner, Robert Mugabe and Grace, because I think they're really lining up their ducks. They have a scheme, they have a plan, and they're slowly rolling it out. Biggest loser, the Zimbabwean economy.
It's not listed.
That's the problem.
I don't borrow any more books.
Oh, come on.
I was
unacademic. I was very normal. I didn't try to be pretentious.
I've seen your website and you strike me as those guys that were unfairly unfair, because Kuma books my gona, I bet you in sport you're also quite talented, and you always used to be like, "Sha, how can this guy get everything?"
actually, I was very poor at sports and women. Very poor.
Sports and women. Why are they in the same category?
I'm glad you separated the two. I think women is a
Hansi, how is this?
Hansi, I was, so clearly things have changed over the years.
I don't know about the women, maybe sports.
Wow.
Upen, you taking shots there. Wow.
You've lost us as a constituency.
All right. Doctor, do you have any exciting projects that our listeners should look out for, and where can they find you online and read more of your or read your writings, actually?
I wish I wrote more in the public sphere. I mean, I used to do that in the past, but I haven't been doing so as much of late, writing in newspapers and the sort. I don't know. I think you sometimes get to a stage where in your life, and I think this is probably where I am right now, where you're a bit more, for some reason, hesitant about whatever views you put out. And one of the reasons actually I agreed to come on this show was, you know, it's you know, the style, the format in which it's done, it's just four of us sitting around having a conversation, laughs, and the sort. I didn't have to be particularly serious about putting across solutions or grand ideas. I think I've just become more hesitant about talking in the public sphere, just more self-critical about that. That's what stopped me. But project-wise, I've been very busy with a number of things. We'll have a book coming out at some point about the life of one Solomon Mujuru. That's my big thing, and would like to do a documentary to accompany that as well. That's kind of where I am right now. Moving on from there, I think within like the coming year, I think I really want to get something, a book about why Mugabe lasted so long. You know, durability. Why is he still here?
No alcohol and a relatively meat-free diet.
Could be. But you know what I mean. I mean politically. I think that's a fascinating
question. And be faithful to his wife.
So his wife said. But it's an interesting question because, you know, it's very rare that an African leader particularly comes under the kind of international scrutiny and pressure and isolation that he faced for over a decade, and come out of that still on top. So I think it's an interesting question to pose.
That would be an interesting study and certainly an interesting read if you know if people are willing to open up. I'm sure a lot more people will be willing to do so in a post Mugabe era. I wonder how you'd interact with certain people, you know, today, what all these political sort of situations and issues continue to play out. But yeah, definitely looking forward to your book as well. When is it coming, the Solomon Mujuru one?
I don't know yet. I don't know.
Depending on how 2018 goes, is that what you're saying?
No, depending on the publisher. In Intakapeta, the publisher asked.
When if you register to vote, you can get the book.
Yeah, if you register to vote, you can get the book. That's a great way to say it.
So you heard it. Yeah, the Blitz is happening. Just a reminder to everyone, the Blitz registration is happening. So please make sure that you are registered to vote. That's the first step. You have to be registered. So make sure you go out there. Yeah, so where can people find you online?
MilesTendy.com.
Okay. MilesTendy.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. This has been fun. I'm very relaxed. No pressure. It's just laughs and just.
We might get you back to forward. talk Brexit in Zimbabwe. That's one.
Happy to get the British ambassador as well.
yes.
Oh yeah, that would be
Katrina.
Katrina.
The friend of the crocodile.
No comment.
Yeah, so you've been listening to Politics and Beyond on Capital 263. Please follow our page, Politics and Beyond on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Poly and Beyond ZW. You can find me at Chris Charamba on all social media.
I'm Upenyumakoni Matenga. I almost forgot my own name. At Upenyumakoni everywhere.
And I'm at Henry Beatty everywhere.
Yeah.
And I'm Miles Tendy. Thanks for listening.
Cheers. Free to say it.
Free to do it.